So before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 24 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Yeah, it's a great tool.
You can check it out at CertFuel.com. So, okay, picture a world where money is just changing hands left and right.
Oh boy.
Like, we're talking all expenses paid trips to the Bahamas, random $500 gift cards just showing up in the mail, retiring brokers raking in massive checks from some golf course down in Florida,
It's been pretty nice.
right? It sounds like the absolute Wild West. But we are actually looking at the highly regulated, heavily scrutinized world of FINRA compensation practices.
Yeah. And, it might look like the Wild West from the outside with all those lavish perks flying around, but the reality is a lot closer to a maximum security prison.
A prison with really nice golf, I guess.
Right, exactly. Because every single dollar, every single trip, every golf outing, it's tracked. It's capped or governed by this very specific set of regulatory tripwires. And since our listener today is sitting for the Series 24 exam, they aren't just memorizing these rules to follow them. They're memorizing them because they are going to be the principal.
The boss.
Yeah, the one who goes down with the ship if the firm's compliance systems fail.
Wow. Okay, no pressure. But that is exactly the mindset we need today. We're diving deep into the FANRA Rule 3220 series, the SEC's pay-to-play regulations, and those non-cash compensation frameworks straight from your Series 24 study stack.
Because, I mean, you already passed the Series 7. You already know what a mutual fund is. You know what a broker-dealer does. Our mission today is to look at this from the supervisory level.
Like the eagle-eye view. How do you govern exactly who gets paid, how they get paid, and how every last cent of it is recorded?
Precisely.
So, if you're studying for the 24 right now, I have a direct question for you. How confident are you that you can spot the mechanical difference between a perfectly legal internal sales contest and a massive firm-destroying regulatory violation?
And that is the exact line the exam tests. I mean, they aren't going to give you some obvious cartoonish fraud.
Like stealing out of a vault.
Right. They're going to give you a scenario that looks like standard business practice. But it hinges on, like, a single missing disclosure or a slight misallocation of funds.
So let's start with how brokers try to woo their clients. Before we even get to the massive product issuers, let's look at the individual rep trying to win business.
The gifts and gratuities minefield.
Exactly, the minefield. So I'm looking at FINRA Rule 3220, and this rule caps what a member firm or an associated person, an AP, can give to a recipient if that gift is, tied to the recipient's employer's business.
Yeah, and we need to start with a very important, highly testable number here, and a bit of historical context too.
Hit me.
So for decades, the FANRA gift limit was stubbornly stuck at $100 per person per year.
Which is nothing.
Right, it was a nightmare for compliance officers.
Yeah.
Because of inflation, you couldn't even buy a decent fruit basket for $100 anymore.
Yeah, you get like three apples and a sad pear.
Exactly. But regulators move slowly, you know? However, effective March 30, 2026, that limit finally increased to $300 per person per year.
Okay, I want to flag something for the listener right now because depending on the exact date in your exam prompt, or if you're using slightly older study materials, you might still see that $100 figure.
Good catch.
Yeah, so lock both numbers in your head. If the question specifies a date before March 30, 2026, it's $100. If it's current, it's $300.
Right, and we're going to use the $300 limit for today's scenarios just to keep it modern.
So why does Fang and Arya care so deeply about this specific number? Do they just hate nice fruit baskets?
Well, historically, before these strict caps were in place, broker-dealers would essentially bribe institutional traders or compliance officers, with lavish gifts just to win their firm's order flow.
Ah, so it's a conflict of interest
A
thing?
massive systemic conflict of interest. Business was being directed based on who gave the best kickbacks, not who provided the best execution for the actual client.
So the $300 cap makes sure a gift is just a nice gesture, not a shadow bribe.
Exactly.
Okay, let's put this into a real-world supervisory scenario. To keep it fun, let's introduce a character. We'll call her Frantic Fiona.
Love it. Frantic Fiona.
Yeah, so Fiona is a registered rep at your firm, and she is absolutely desperate to win this massive institutional account. She really wants to butter up the client's compliance officer.
Okay, setting the stage.
Now, Fiona knows the rule book. She knows she personally cannot exceed the $300 FINRA limit, so she decides to be clever.
Uh-oh. Clever reps are a principal's worst nightmare.
Right. So she gets 5 of her junior team members to each send the compliance officer an $80 artisan cheese basket. 5 times 80 is 400.
Mm.
But as the Series 24 principal, I look at that and think, well, no single individual gave more than $300. So we're in the clear, right?
And that is the exact trap the NRI is waiting for you to fall into. They anticipate that exact behavior.
No way.
Yeah, the rule explicitly states that gifts from the member firm and all of its associated persons to a single recipient are aggregated.
Wait, really? Across the entire firm?
Across the entire firm. You take Fiona's team, you add up those 5 $80 gift baskets, and the aggregate total is $400. That breaches the $300 limit.
Wow. So Fiona just broke the rule.
She sure did. And more importantly, for this Series 24 candidate, if your firm's compliance system didn't catch that 5 different reps sent gifts to the same recipient, you as the principal have a catastrophic failure in your supervisory procedures.
Oh my gosh, that sounds like a logistical nightmare to actually supervise. Like, a firm with 1,000 reps has to have a centralized database just to track if 2 different guys in different cities sent a Starbucks gift card to the same institutional client.
Yes, absolutely. That is exactly why most large broker-dealers implement incredibly strict internal policies.
Like what?
Like, they'll set their internal cap far lower than FIAN or AS limit. Or they require pre-approval for literally any gift, no matter how small, just to prevent those accidental aggregation violations.
Okay, let me push back on the mechanics of this then. What if Fiona abandons the cheese basket idea? She knows the aggregation rule is too risky.
Smart move, Fiona.
Right. So instead, she takes that compliance officer out to a spectacular $500 steakhouse dinner. They eat, they talk business, they have a great time. Did she just violate the $300 limit?
She did not.
Really?
Really.
Yeah.
The mechanism you need to understand here is the regulatory distinction between a gift and business entertainment.
Okay.
If Fiona actually attends that dinner with the client, it is classified as business entertainment. And business entertainment is exempt from the $300 gift cap.
Why the exemption, though? I mean, $500 is $500. Why does FINAR care if it's a cheese basket or a ribeye?
Because of the presence of the rep.
Her physical presence.
Yes. If Fiona is sitting at the table, the primary purpose of the event is assumed to be building a business relationship. They're discussing markets or products or strategy.
So FINAR wants to encourage legitimate business building.
Exactly. Now, it still has to follow other rules. It can't be so lavish or so frequent that it raises a question of propriety.
Yeah.
But it is not subject to that strict $300 mathematical cap.
Okay, so presence is the triggering mechanism.
That's the trigger.
So let's say Fiona has a conflict. She's supposed to go to the dinner, but she can't. She buys a $500 gift card to that exact same steakhouse, mails it to the client, and just stays home to watch TV.
Because she is not present, it reverts to being a gift. It falls right back under Rule 3220. It exceeds $300, and it is a flat-out violation.
I call that the couch potato principle.
Yeah.
If you are sitting on the couch while your client eats the steak, you just committed a regulatory violation.
That is a brilliant way to remember it. The couch potato principle.
Right. But what about life events? Let's say this compliance officer happens to be getting married. Can Fiona buy them a $500 espresso machine off their registry? Or she capped at $300 for weddings, too.
Well, there is a personal carve-out, but you have to look really closely at how the exam phrases the relationship.
Okay.
Personal gifts for personal occasions, like weddings or the birth of a child. They can be completely exempt from the limit. But that exemption only applies if the rep and the client have a genuinely personal relationship that predates and exists entirely outside of the business relationship.
Oh, I see. So if they were college roommates 15 years ago, the espresso machine is totally fine.
Correct. The firm would just document that pre-existing personal relationship.
Right.
But if the only reason Fiona knows this person is because they sit across from each other on institutional trades, there is no personal relationship in the eyes of FINRAO. The wedding gift is capped at $300.
Okay, listener, pause and think about this next scenario, because this is where the exam gets truly brutal.
Oh, yeah. Pay attention here.
Let's say Fiona has a different client. She is trying to win business from an official who oversees a state pension plan. Okay. Fiona sends this state official a beautiful $150 gift basket. She's not on the couch. It's a real gift, but it's only $150. That is well under the current $300 FINRAO limit. So as her principal, do you sign off on this?
Give him a beat to think.
Yeah, think about it. Does she pass?
So if you sign off on that, you might cost your firm millions of dollars.
Ouch.
Yeah. This introduces the concept of overlapping jurisdictions. The FIORA $300 cap is a floor, not a ceiling.
Right.
When you deal with government officials, municipal officials, or pension plan fiduciaries, you step completely out of FINRA's sandbox and into the SEC's territory.
Specifically, the SEC Investment Advisor Pay-to-Play Rule. Rule 206-4-5. It is merciless.
It is designed to be absolutely merciless. Because back in the 1990s, there were these massive scandals. Financial firms were essentially funding the political campaigns of municipal treasurers in exchange for lucrative contracts to manage the state's pension money.
Just straight up buying the business.
Exactly. So to stop this, the SEC implemented the pay-to-play rules. If Fiona gives that $150 gift, which can easily be construed as a political contribution or improper influence under these stricter rules, her firm triggers a 2-year timeout.
Let's make sure the listener understands the gravity of that. A 2-year timeout means what exactly?
It means the entire broker-dealer is legally banned from receiving any compensation for managing or advising that government entity's funds for 2 solid years.
Whoa.
Yeah. A $150 gift basket could literally vaporize a multi-million dollar institutional contract.
That is terrifying for a principal.
So on the Series 24, the moment you see the words government official, municipal entity, or union pension rep in a question prompt, alarm bells need to ring in your head. Ignore the FINRA limit. Look for the stricter SEC rule.
That is a phenomenal transition point, actually, because we've spent time looking at how frantic Fiona tries to win over her clients. But what happens when the tables are turned?
And the big fish come after Fiona.
Exactly. What happens when massive mutual fund companies or variable annuity issuers try to bribe Fiona?
This brings us to the rules governing cash and non-cash compensation, specifically for variable contracts, mutual funds, direct participation programs, and public offerings.
Okay.
And FINRA's regulatory philosophy here is super simple. They want to obliterate issuer-tied incentives.
But why? I mean, if a mutual fund company wants to give a rep a Rolex for selling their fund, isn't that just standard sales motivation? Like ABC, always be closing.
Because it fundamentally biases the advice the customer receives. Think about it. If Megacorp Mutual Funds is dangling a Rolex for hitting a sales target, Fiona is going to look at every single client who walks through the door and try to shove them into a Megacorp fund.
Even if it's terrible for them.
Exactly. Regardless of whether a different fund family would be more suitable for that specific investor's risk profile, the compensation structure completely destroys the rep's objectivity.
Oh, so FINRA lays down the law.
They do.
And there are exactly 4 and only 4 permitted categories of non-cash compensation that a product sponsor can provide. Let's run through them.
Okay.
First, gifts that fall under that $300 limit we just covered. Second, occasional meals and entertainment, provided the offeror actually attends. Again, the couch potato principle applies.
Right.
Third, offer-funded training and education. And fourth, internal non-cash arrangements, which usually means sales contests.
And that fourth category, internal sales contests, is heavily tested on the Series 24.
Oh, absolutely. So if your member firm decides to run a sales contest to motivate the floor, you, as the principal, must ensure it strictly adheres to the total production rule.
The total production rule. Very important.
So I want to try to find a loophole here. Let's test this. Let's say Fiona's firm wants to boost variable annuity sales. Can the firm put up a whiteboard and say, whoever sells the most megacorp annuities this month wins a trip to Hawaii?
No. That is a direct violation.
Not even if it's internal?
No, because the total production rule mandates that an internal sales contest must credit all eligible products equally.
Oh, I see.
If you run a contest for variable annuities, you cannot isolate and reward the sale of a specific issuer like Megacorp.
Yeah.
You must reward the sale of any variable annuity that the firm has a selling agreement for, giving equal weight to all of them.
What if I slice it differently, though? What if I say, okay, we won't isolate Megacorp, but we really want to push growth mutual funds right now. So the contest is only for growth funds, and it completely excludes bond funds. Is that allowed?
Actually, yes. That is an acceptable structural division.
Really? Why?
Because you are allowed to separate a contest by product type. You can have a contest exclusively for mutual funds, or exclusively for variable annuities, or just growth funds. But within that defined product type, you can never, ever segregate by the specific issuer or fund family.
Oh, so I can't say only Megacorp growth funds.
Exactly. The moment you favor one sponsor over another, you introduce the very bias FINRA is trying to prevent.
Okay, listener, breaking the fourth wall here. I want you to visualize this scenario and tell me if it passes the test. Fiona's firm sends out a company-wide email. Sell $1 million of any mutual fund we offer from any sponsor, and you win a trip.
Take a second. Is that legal?
Yeah, think about it.
It is legal.
Yes.
Because it is based on total production across all mutual funds the firm offers. It does not favor Vanguard over Fidelity or Megacorp over anyone else. It complies with the rule perfectly.
Boom. Okay, let's talk about the third category of non-cash compensation, offer-funded training. Because this is where the product issuers get incredibly creative.
Oh, they try everything.
Right. Let's say Megacorp realizes they can't sponsor a sales contest just for their annuities. So they approach Fiona directly and say, hey, Fiona, we are hosting a mandatory, highly rigorous 8-hour-a-day trading seminar on the complex tax structures of our new products.
Sounds boring, but compliant so far.
Right, but wait. We are hosting it at a luxury beach resort in Fiji. We'll fly you out. And you know what? We value family, so we'll cover your husband's flight and hotel, too.
Okay. As the principal reviewing that invitation, you have to reject it immediately.
But it's an 8-hour-a-day rigorous training.
It doesn't matter. There are two glaring violations here. The first is the appropriate location rule.
Ah.
Historically, product sponsors used, quote-unquote, training seminars, thin veil for all expenses paid vacations to golf resorts. To stop this, Finari requires that an offeror-funded training meeting be held at an appropriate location.
Which means what, exactly? What is appropriate?
It generally means an office of the offeror, an office of your member firm, or a recognized regional corporate center.
So like a boring conference room in Chicago.
Exactly. Fiji is a resort destination. Finari does not care if the training agenda is 14 hours a day of brutal, intense product education. A resort does not qualify as an appropriate location, period.
It's a vacation dress up in a suit.
Yeah.
What about the spouse, though? Megacorp said they value family. Can't they buy him a ticket?
That is the second violation. Product offers can never, under any circumstances, pay the expenses for a spouse or a guest.
Never.
Never. Fiona's husband is legally allowed to attend the trip if it were at a legitimate location. Say, that conference room in Chicago, but Fiona or her husband must pay his entire way out of pocket.
Yeah.
If Megacorp buys his plane ticket, it is an illegal non-cash compensation transfer.
Okay, so Fiji is out and the free husband ticket is out. Poor Fiona.
Mm.
Let's shift gears.
Let's do it.
Fiona's firm is growing. They have just signed a major deal to set up a brokerage desk right inside the lobby of a local community bank. And you, as the listener, are the principal in charge of supervising this new desk.
We are now dealing with networking arrangements. And while you probably already know what a networking arrangement is from your Series 7 as a principal, you need to understand the psychology of why they are so dangerous.
I call this the halo effect.
Exactly, the halo effect. When a retail customer walks into a bank lobby, they feel a deep sense of safety. They see the marble columns, the vault, the FDIC stickers on the door.
They trust it.
They expect that anything sold in that building is a guaranteed bank product. So if they sit down at Fiona's desk, which happens to be 10 feet away from the teller line, and buy a volatile emerging markets mutual fund, the risk of customer confusion is massive.
They might think the bank is guaranteeing their mutual fund against loss.
Right, which is why FINRA and the SEC require strict, specific disclosures to shatter that halo effect.
Okay, let's introduce our next character. Right next to Fiona's new desk, behind the glass, is Banker Bob. Bob is a friendly, unregistered bank teller. He knows everyone in town.
Good old Bob.
Good old Bob. But before we look at Bob's behavior, let's look at Fiona. A customer sits at her desk. What exactly does she have to disclose to shatter that halo?
There are four mandatory pillars of disclosure here. She must inform the customer that the securities product is not FDIC insured, it is not a bank deposit, it is not guaranteed by the bank, and it is subject to investment risk, including the possible loss of principal.
Okay, not FDIC, not a deposit, not guaranteed investment risk. I get the what. But the exam is going to test the how. Does she just like hand them a brochure? Does she have to read it out loud like a Miranda warning?
This is a prime exam trap. The mechanical difference between written and oral disclosure.
Okay.
Written disclosure is always required. Every single account opened under a networking arrangement must have that signed piece of paper. But when is oral disclosure required? It is only triggered if the account is opened on the premises of the financial institution.
Let me make sure I have this straight. If a customer physically walks into the bank lobby, sits at Fiona's desk, and opens the account right there in person, she has to hand them the Form A and D. She has to verbally tell them out loud.
Correct. Location dictates the oral requirement. But let's say Banker Bob tells a customer about Fiona. That customer takes Fiona's business card, goes home, and opens the account over the phone from their living room. while Fiona is at the branch.
Ah.
In that scenario, the written disclosure is mailed or emailed, but no oral disclosure is legally required because the account was not opened on the physical premises of the bank.
That is a very subtle distinction, but exactly what a principal needs to audit. Speaking of Banker Bob, though, he is watching Fiona rake in commissions from all these wealthy local business owners he's sending over from his teller line.
Bob's getting jealous.
Bob wants a piece of the action. So he approaches Fiona and says, look, I'll keep sending you my best banking clients, but I want 1% of the assets they transfer over to your brokerage account. I feel like I know the answer to this, but what happens if Fiona agrees?
They both get fired. And the regulators get involved.
Boo.
Yeah. The rules for compensating unregistered bank employees in a networking arrangement are aggressively strict. An unregistered bank employee can only receive a one-time nominal cash referral fee.
Nominal, like a flat 25 or 50 bucks, not a percentage.
Right. No percentages. But here's the real trap for the Series 24 candidate. What is that fee contingent upon? That nominal fee must be contingent only on the customer contacting the broker-dealer.
Wait, I would have assumed it was contingent on the account actually opening. Why would the firm pay Bob just for a hello?
Because if the payment is contingent on the account opening, or worse, contingent on the execution of a trade, the nature of the payment changes entirely. It becomes transaction-based compensation.
Oh, and you can't have that.
No. The SEC's core philosophy is follow the money. If you get paid like a broker, meaning your compensation is tied to the successful sale of securities, you must be registered as a broker.
So if Bob only gets his 50 bucks when the client actually buys a mutual fund, Bob is illegally acting as an unregistered broker.
Yes. And it actually gets worse for the bank. Banks operate these networking arrangements under a specific exemption from the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which is what allows them to avoid registering as broker deals themselves. If they allow their tellers to receive transaction-based compensation, they blow up their GLBA exemption.
Wow.
Yeah, the entire bank is now illegally operating as an unregistered broker-dealer.
It is terrifying how fast a friendly referral turns into a federal securities violation.
It really is.
Which transitions us perfectly into the broader concept of payments to unregistered persons. You just said the SEC's philosophy is follow the money. If you aren't registered, you can't get paid commissions. But this is the Series 24. There are always exceptions, right?
Oh, absolutely. There are two very narrow, highly specific exceptions to this rule that you absolutely must memorize. And remember, the burden of proof is always on the member firm to justify paying an unregistered person.
All right, let's explore the first exception. Enter character number 3, retired Ricky.
Good old Ricky.
Yep. Ricky was a star broker at Fiona's firm for 40 years. He built a massive book of business, millions in assets under management. But now he's hanging it up. He's moving to a golf community in Florida and letting his Series 7 and 24 laps.
Enjoying the sunshine.
Living the dream. But Ricky's book generates massive trail commissions, like 12B1 fees for mutual funds he sold decades ago. Can your firm legally keep paying Ricky those trails after he retires and is no longer registered?
Yes, under the continuing commissions exception.
Okay.
But the mechanical preconditions are absolute. First, there must be a bona fide written contract entered into while Ricky was still actively registered.
Let me push back on that timing. What if they had a verbal agreement at his retirement party, and then a month after he moves to Florida, compliance realizes they forgot the paperwork and they draft the contract then?
The exception is totally void.
Wait, really? Just because of the timing?
Exactly. If that written contract isn't executed before his registration actually lapses, you have zero legal authority to pay him. Paying him would be a direct violation of the unregistered person's prohibition.
So the timing of the paperwork is critical. Got it. What else?
The continuing commissions can only be generated from his existing continuing accounts. The firm will usually assign a junior rep to actively manage those accounts, and they split the trails with Ricky. But Ricky cannot solicit any new business whatsoever.
Okay, and here's the classic exam gotcha. Listeners, pay attention. Ricky is bored down in Florida. He misses the action. He decides to call up his favorite old client from the golf course. He says, hey, Jim, just checking in on the family. By the way, the market looks choppy. You might want to ask your new rep about rebalancing those tech stocks.
Uh-oh.
What just happened?
Ricky just blew up his exemption.
Over a quick chat.
The rule strictly prohibits the retiring rep from servicing existing accounts. The SEC's biggest fear here is the creation of shadow brokers. You know, people who are no longer registered, no longer subject to continuing education or active supervision, but who are still secretly directing client assets behind the scenes.
Because if he is giving advice, he's acting like a broker.
Precisely. Servicing includes account reviews, recommendations, or taking orders. The minute Ricky gives a tip or discusses the portfolio, he is engaging in broker activity. Because he is unregistered, he is breaking the law. And if your firm continues to pay him after knowing this, your firm is breaking the law too.
Ricky has to just play golf, collect his checks, and stay off the phone.
Pretty much.
Okay, that's the continuing commissions exception. The second exception for paying unregistered people is the foreign finder. Let's say Fiona has a contact in Paris. We'll call him Parisian Pierre.
Bonjour, Pierre.
He is totally unregistered, never set foot in the U.S., but he runs in very wealthy European circles. He refers non-U.S. citizens to Fiona's firm in New York. Can she pay him a finder's fee?
Yes, under the foreign finder exception. But again, look at the mechanics. The customers must be actual foreign nationals, not U.S. citizens living abroad.
Oh, that's a good distinction.
Yeah. And the customers must receive written disclosure of the compensation paid to the finder, and they must acknowledge that arrangement in writing. Furthermore, every single trade confirmation sent to that client has to explicitly state that a finder's fee is being paid.
Okay, I want to test the boundaries of Pierre's role. Yeah. Let's say Fiona gets the referral and she sets up a Zoom call with this wealthy French investor, but the investor's English isn't great. So Pierre, who made the intro, sits in on the Zoom meeting. He doesn't recommend anything. He doesn't discuss performance. He literally just translates Fiona's English into French.
Okay.
That has to be okay, right? He's just being helpful.
It is absolutely not okay.
You're kidding.
Nope. This is a crucial area for a principal to monitor. The SEC condition is initial referral only. It is a strictly binary rule. If the finder does anything beyond providing the initial introduction, if they attend a meeting, if they translate documents, if they help the client fill out the account opening paperwork, they have crossed the line.
Even translating, that feels overly strict. I mean, he's just acting as a human dictionary.
It is strict by design. The moment they participate in the mechanics of the securities process, they are acting as an unregistered broker in the U.S. market. The exception is immediately voided.
Wow. Initial referral means initial referral, and then you vanish into the Parisian night.
Exactly.
Oof.
Gone.
Okay, we've looked at non-registered outsiders, banker Bob, retired Ricky, Parisian Pierre, but what about the non-registered people working inside Fiona's actual branch office? This brings us to persons exempt from registration, or what I call the clerical trap.
Every broker-dealer relies on support staff, right? Administrative assistants, receptionists, back office clerks.
Sure, you couldn't run a firm without them.
Exactly. The foundational rule is that if an employee's duties are solely and exclusively clerical or ministerial, they do not need to hold a series license. But the moment their duties cross over into broker activities, the firm is exposed.
And what is the brightest line you can possibly cross in a brokerage office? Taking an order. The rule is incredibly explicit. Accepting a customer order is never a clerical function.
Never. If an unregistered assistant discusses order details, confirms parameters, or routes an order to the trading desk, they are acting as an unregistered broker.
Okay, listener, I'm putting you on the spot again as the principal. Let's say Fiona is the only registered rep in her small satellite branch. She steps away to use the bathroom.
Nature calls.
Right. And the phone rings. It's Fiona's biggest client, and they're in full panic mode. The market is tanking, and they are screaming to sell 1,000 shares of Apple right this exact second. Fiona's unregistered clerical assistant answers the phone. What exactly can the assistant do?
Well, under the standard rule, they can do absolutely nothing except take a message.
Which the client is going to hate.
Yes. However, Fanarot provides a very narrow, highly specific safe harbor for exactly this kind of operational emergency. The unregistered assistant is allowed to occasionally transcribe the details of an unsolicited order.
Transcribe, meaning they grab a sticky note and write, client wants to sell 1,000 Apple at market.
Yes.
But here is the exam trap. The sequence of what happens next matters completely. The assistant cannot just hand that sticky note to the trading desk to be executed, right?
That is the critical sequence.
Yeah.
The safe harbor requires two distinct steps. First, the unregistered person transcribes the order. Second, the registered person, Fiona, when she gets back from the bathroom, must subsequently contact the customer to confirm the details before the order is ever entered into the system.
Oh, so Fiona has to call the screaming client back, say, I understand you want to sell 1,000 Apple. I am confirming this. And then she can enter it.
Exactly. If the assistant enters it or if Fiona enters it without making that confirmation call, the safe harbor is blown.
And as a principal, you need to focus on a specific word in that rule. Occasionally. FINRA designed this as an emergency backup valve for when a registered person is temporarily unavailable. It's not a business model.
Right. Let's play that out. Say Fiona decides she likes this system. She starts having her unregistered assistant transcribe client orders every single morning for an hour while Fiona goes out to get a latte.
It sounds convenient for Fiona.
Sure. But even if Fiona religiously calls every single client back to confirm the orders before entering them, it is still a massive violation.
Why? She's following the sequence, right?
Because a daily habit is not occasional. If transcribing orders becomes a routine structural workflow of that branch, the firm has effectively delegated the function of order taking to an unregistered person. The safe harbor vanishes entirely.
I love that distinction. It is an emergency parachute, not your daily commute.
Perfectly said.
And let's talk about the financial side of that assistant. Can Fiona give her assistant a bonus at the end of the year for being so helpful under pressure?
She can give a standard discretionary bonus based on overall administrative performance, or pay an hourly wage or fixed salary. But an unregistered clerical employee can never receive transaction-based compensation.
So no profit sharing on specific trades.
Exactly. If Fiona says, I'll give you $10 for every order you successfully transcribe, or I'll give you 1% of my total commissions for the month, the assistant's bonus is now directly tied to broker outcomes. That instantly transforms the assistant's role into broker activity in the eyes of the SEC, invalidating their clerical exemption.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground. We've gone through $300 gift caps, trips to Fiji, bank tellers, retired brokers, and bathroom emergencies.
It's a lot.
But here is the harsh reality of the Series 24. FANRO doesn't just take your word for it that you followed all these complex compensation rules. When the auditors show up, you have to prove it on paper. Which brings us to the mechanism that enforces all of this. Record keeping.
The per AP compensation record-keeping rule is what gives this entire regulatory framework teeth. A broker-dealer must maintain a granular record of every single purchase and sale of a security that is attributable for compensation purposes to an associated person.
So every trade tied to a rep.
Right. And crucially, that record must show both monetary compensation like cash commissions and non-monetary compensation.
Wait, let me connect this back to Fiona's internal sales contest. The legal one, based on total production, where she sold $1 million in mutual funds and won the trip to Hawaii.
Yeah.
Are you telling me that as the principal, I can't just keep a folder in my compliance office that says Hawaii contest rules and check a box that Fiona won the trip?
I'm telling you exactly that. Just keeping the contest rules in a file folder is a record-keeping violation.
Oh, wow.
The non-monetary compensation requirement dictates a much heavier data burden. The actual cash value of that Hawaii trip has to be mathematically allocated across the specific trades that earned her the trip.
Seriously?
Yeah. The firm's records must answer on a trade-by-trade basis. For this specific 100-share transaction, what compensation, both cash and non-cash, flowed to Fiona?
That sounds like a data architecture nightmare. You have to track the value of a hotel room in Hawaii down to a specific mutual fund ticket.
It is an incredible amount of data. And historically, it was almost impossible for firms to print this out on a daily basis, which is why the SEC offers an alternative compliance method called produce on request.
Okay, that sounds a bit more reasonable.
Firms do not have to continuously generate a static, printed daily record of all this aggregated compensation. But they must have systems capable of promptly generating it if a regulator asks.
Let's test the produce on request rule. I like to think of it like a restaurant health inspection. It's not enough to have the ingredients in the fridge and a recipe in the drawer. If the health inspector asks to see a baked cake, you can't ask for 3 weeks to bake it. You must be able to serve it promptly.
That is a perfect analogy. Here is the exam trap on this. Let's say FIMARA walks into your firm and says, show us Fiona's total compensation record, including the Hawaii trip allocation.
Right.
And you, as the principal, say, sure. We have the trading data in this legacy mainframe, the payroll data in this cloud software, and the contest expenses in this Excel spreadsheet on the marketing manager's laptop. Give us 3 weeks to hire a data scientist to merge it all together.
So the data is technically in the building, but the cake isn't baked.
Exactly. That is a violation. The firm must be able to promptly produce a coherent, per rep, per transaction view. If it takes weeks to compile because your databases don't talk to each other, your systems are deemed inadequate, and you fail the record-keeping rule.
And the regulators aren't just looking to see what Fiona was paid, right? They want to prove she was paid correctly according to the firm's own internal policies.
Yes, they are auditing your internal math, which is why the rule requires the firm to maintain two very specific documents side by side.
Okay, what are they?
First, the firm-wide commission and concession schedules. This is the master rate card that says, for example, all equity mutual funds pay a 3% gross commission. Second, you must maintain the summary of the specific AP's compensation arrangement. This is Fiona's employment contract that says Fiona gets a 50% payout of gross commissions.
So the auditor looks at the master schedule, looks at Fiona's summary, and does the math themselves. 3% total commission, Fiona gets half, so she should get 1.5%.
You got it.
Then they look at the per AP transaction record to see if she actually received 1.5%. If the numbers don't match, the firm is paying people off the books or misallocating funds, and you have some serious explaining to do.
Right, and you must have both the master schedule and the individual summary on file. If you only have one, the auditor can't prove the math, and it is an automatic record-keeping violation.
All right, we just covered a massive amount of regulatory architecture. Let's bring it all home with a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways from everything we just discussed. Listener, lock these in.
Number one. The FINRA gift limit is $300 per person, per year, effective March 30, 2026. Remember the trap. You must aggregate all gifts from all APs at the firm to a single recipient.
And if you are eating the steak with them, it's entertainment, not a gift.
Exactly. Number two, internal sales contests are only legal if they equal credit across all issuers within a specific product type. That is the total production rule. You can separate by mutual fund versus annuity, but never by the fund family.
Number three, offer-funded training must be held at an appropriate location, like an office or a regional center, absolutely not a resort, and $0 can go to spouses or guests.
Number four, unregistered bank employees in a networking arrangement can only receive a one-time nominal cash fee for referrals. Crucially, it must be contingent only on customer contact, not on opening an account or executing a trade.
Number five, retiring reps like Ricky can get continuing commissions, but they need a written contract before the registration lapses, and they absolutely cannot service the accounts post-retirement. No golf course stock tips.
And number six, unregistered clerical assistants can occasionally transcribe an order in an emergency, but a registered rep must subsequently confirm those details with the client before the order is entered. It is a parachute, not a daily routine.
We started this deep dive talking about the wild west of trips to the Bahamas and cash changing hands, but hopefully you now see the incredibly tight, highly supervised net of rules FINRA uses to regulate every penny.
Yeah, and as you take your Series 24 exam, why don't you step back from the memorization and think about the philosophy behind all of this.
The why.
Exactly. Every single one of these rules, the $300 gift cap, the total production requirement, the ban on paying unregistered finders, the strict oral disclosures in a bank lobby, they exist for one singular reason: to sever the hidden financial ties that bias a broker's advice.
Wow, yeah.
So whenever you're stuck on a complication question, just ask yourself a simple question. Does this payment structure incentivize the rep to prioritize their own wallet over the customer's best interest?
And if the answer is yes, you've likely found your regulatory violation. Keep that question in your head, apply it to the mechanical traps we covered today, and you are going to crush this section of the exam. Until next time, keep studying.